This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Yeah, I'm Mark Stevens. Thanks very much for downloading this. We are building the Scotland Outdoors podcast out of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. Very varied this week. This is what we're going up to.
I came out of the house at about, I don't know, maybe 4:30 this morning. It's flat calm and just a sky full of stars. It was fabulous. Venus was really bright. Mars was really red. There was no moon. It was superb. And obviously the stars have disappeared, and it's not quite light yet. But just, literally, just as that last programme finished, and I stood up to speak to you, the lights went off outside the BBC. They're trying to tell us something. I'm Mark Stephen, 40 miles to the north, Mr. Ewan McElrath.
Broadcasting by a hurricane lamp as ever, but you're right, it was an absolute carpet of stars this morning. Just 10, 15 minutes ago, the last of the stars, Venus, disappeared. Had two bats patrolling right in front of me, 5 feet away. And just in the last couple of minutes, they landed on the wall, 10 feet away from me, and I just watched them crawling up and in behind the guttering. Just an absolute delight this morning.
I got a phone call as well. I was away down in Dumfries. I got a phone call, when was it, on Wednesday night? My wife saying, there's a bat in the living room. Yes, yeah, fine. Okay, just go into the other room. It says, switch the light off, open the window. I've taken professional advice on this now. I know what to do about it. But actually, this thing rested on the curtain. And she just gently picked it up in a tea towel and put it back outside again. Where they're coming from, however, that's another point.
Well, they're in the loft and they're hatching out. Anyway, more on bats later on.
Hatching out.
We're always keen to hear your bat stories. Tell us what you're up to. Tell us how to get rid of bats if it's in the living room. Out of doors at bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295. Now, this is a lot to take in at this time of the morning, but stick with us. Tweet at BBC Out of Doors. There's Facebook. We've got a phone as well. Lewis is handling that. He's on 0800. Tell us what you're doing.
It's been a busy week. It's been a busy week in Out of Doors. Well, last week we told you how our trip to the Bass Rock had been postponed due to bad weather, but yesterday, gentle listener, the weather was superb and we got the most glorious of days and we managed to get out there to the world's largest colony of northern gannets.
Yeah, I've done a fair bit in my time. You know, I've been with the gorillas in the mist in Rwanda. I've swum with sea lions in the Galapagos. Heard wolves in northern Canada. We braved the Bunxies in St Kilda. But yesterday was fantastic. We'll bring you more description of this, but we're both bowled over. But here's a wee snippet of the sound and a wee bit of Mark as we encountered the world's largest colony of northern gannets.
If you just imagine standing on a rock, not terribly far away from Edinburgh, but surrounded by tens of thousands of these really quite large birds, it was just fascinating. And that's coming up in a future programme. Do you want to talk about your sort of innate heroism? Stoicism?
Well, yes. You were we were climbing up, and it got better and better and better, and more and more and more. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly we got to the bit where the path was littered with razor-wielding gannets. Mm-hmm. And they were getting upset. And the first one jumped up and hit me in the side. That was sore. And then this other one snuck up behind me, and it was kind of a 4.5-inch gash on my leg, which started bleeding. Did I get sympathy? Not a whit.
I would argue the term gash. Scratch, possibly. Just about.
It's bleeding, it's a gash.
It's World Alzheimer's Day on Monday. All next week, Radio Scotland will be looking at dementia awareness and programmes across the station. We're just going to be a wee bit ahead of the game here on Out the Doors, because quite a few of our pieces today are going to focus on the positive effect that being in the outdoors can have on people living with dementia, and for those caring for them.
Yeah, my dad suffered really badly at the hands of dementia. It was just a terrible thing to watch him to retreat into a place that certainly I never want to be. But Dad was an artist, he loved the outside, and he just blossomed a bit when there was birds in the garden or he could see the trees. I'm no expert, but it really, really seemed to help him. And we'd like to hear from you about the stories about the benefits of being outdoors, if you'd had personal experience of those living with dementia, and how the outdoors or nature sounds has been of benefit. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or give Lewis a ring on 08085 92 9500.
Talking of sounds, mystery bird time. Your first chance to have a go at what this bird might be, and it's a slight deviation from the norm this week. Mr. McElraith and I, equity card holders both, are going to recreate the sound ourselves. Indeed. You know, so are you ready on my count? One, two, three. Send money or help too.
Have you any idea about that? Might be. Do you care? We promised to give you an actual bird sound in a minute or two, but the sound we're making is really not far off it. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Give Lewis a ring on 0885 9295 if you know what this is.
See, I must go. You're better than me. You were organised. I forgot to bring an empty bottle in this morning. Thankfully.
Well, you're struggling to find an empty bottle in
the BBC. Where would you find an empty bottle? I went up to Newsroom. You know, basically, I went into their crate, you know, and I tell you, you could have a good night out in the fumes from that. Anyway, over the last few months, it's safe to say that more of us have been aware of the birds in our patch, from the enjoyment of feeding them to the sounds that they make. Birds are fantastic things. They can be uplifting, comical, poignant, and just downright weird. Not to mention dangerous and leaving you with a 6-inch gash. Interacting with birds has got a very positive effect, however, for some people who live with dementia. A few years ago, Helen spoke to a fascinating guy, Ken Elkins, of the National Audubon Society in Connecticut. You hear that? That was a peregrine falcon in the background. Whoa. I wonder if it's back up in the spire again. Anyway, as I was saying, Ken Elkins of the National Audubon Society in Connecticut. Ken's love of birds inspired him to set up the Bird Tales programme, which now exists in care homes across the country.
My love of birds started when I was about 10 years old at my grandmother's house. That we always enjoyed watching the birds at our bird feeder, but one morning in particular, we woke up and there was this little black-capped chickadee that had hit its head on the patio door. And my grandmother taught me how to hold this bird. And for this short while, maybe 10 minutes or so, I got this opportunity to hold on to this bird and help it back to health. And I watched it kind of wake up. And during my programs with people with dementia, we kind of use that experience as the opening moments of the program, that I have everyone hold on to a model of a bird. It might not be a black-capped chickadee, but everyone gets that same sort of experience of holding on to a bird. I was able to remember the senses of that moment and how I felt, how the opportunity to feel how soft its feathers on its chest were. And that opportunity to get to see its eyes open up. And you don't normally get to see a bird's eyes when they're out there in the trees and the bushes at a distance. But this bird was right there in my hand. So I could see those things and notice the exact shapes of its beak as it opened up and yawned for the first time while it was groggy. So I use those moments to kind of help everyone else get that feeling, that emotion. And being able to connect with nature, it might not have been an experience like that they had before, but it makes them start to think again about a time they might have been outdoors and seen a bird that surprised them, and the sense of awe that you have when you watch these creatures outdoors.
And what impact do you see this having, this interaction with birds in particular, with people who are living with dementia?
Most of the people I've been able to interact with who are living with dementia, they are living in long-term care facilities or dementia care facilities. And the number one focus of the staff there is their health of these residents. So they don't get outdoors as often. And whenever I can bring in any sounds of nature and the hint of nature, it wakes them up. And once we start to get to know them a little bit, if I can hear some life stories of where they've been, I can hopefully think of a bird or two that they probably interacted with. So, for example, there was this one woman, Emmeline, who seemed like she was asleep most of the time. She really wasn't very talkative at all. But once they introduced her to me as a woman who had been an equestrian her entire life, I put down the bright red cardinal and the blue jay and the yellow goldfinch and instead went to the bottom of my collection of birds and brought out a barn swallow. The swallow is a bird that lives on every continent, and I'd like to know of a horse barn that doesn't have one nesting in it. So I put this bird in her hands. Her eyes were still closed. So I was able to help her imagine the bird by feeling it. We took her fingers and let her feel the long pointy wings and the long pointy tail that has a fork in it. And I started playing the sound of the bird over and over again to her as I was squeezing the bird model. And her eyes just absolutely snapped open after a moment. And she looked up at me and she just smiled like she recognized that sound. I heard from the staff that entire afternoon she was chatting away about horses the rest of the day.
Wow, so you'd really provoked something within her, deep within her. You'd kind of sparked her up again.
Yes. People living with dementia, we might not always know what's going on. So our only information we can gather is their outward reactions. So whenever we can evoke a smile or just even this light in their eyes, then we know that we've done our job at that moment of brightening up their day.
And why do you think it's birds in particular that seems to be so effective and bird song?
Well, birds are always around us. Even in urban environments, you can find birds. And people with dementia are living somewhere in the past. We're not exactly always sure where they are in their lives. But the memories that they have around them that they're able to access, because their short-term memory is faded away, we might not know where that is, but we try the best we can to be able to help them with that. And also, the other technique is that all these sensory activities and the sounds of the birds in particular are calming, is that if we can help improve their mood at that moment, we know that they're, through research, that their change in their mood will stick with them for hours throughout the day. They won't remember what helped them get into a good mood, but they will be much happier throughout the day. You can ask them and they'll say, I'm in such a great mood today. I don't know why, but hopefully we can track it back and it was the bird sounds.
Ken Elkins of the National Audubon Society back in 2016 speaking to Helen about his Bird Tales programme for care homes. An excellent idea that, Ewan. It just, you know, it basically forms an almost immediate connection in people's minds.
Yeah, it's a great idea, and you know, the RSPB and people sell these little cuddly toys that you press and it gives the song. What a great idea and what a great story. It was actually triggered by, I was looking in the Seabird Centre at North Berwick yesterday, and they've got some of these cuddly toys that would do that kind of job. And apropos of that, great news that the Seabird Centre, which was in danger of closing, actually achieved their target for fundraising, so they're not going bust, they are surviving, and thanks to them for taking us out yesterday.
Yeah, excellent. No, it was ideal. Listen, I don't know if you can hear this, but I'll probably stop doing it, needless to say, as soon as I shut up. Here you go. Which, of course, it did. Right. Church spire, less than 100 metres away, 30 feet, 30, 40 feet down from the top. There are little spires surrounding the main one, and it's sitting there grooming itself. I can see it quite clearly. Just fascinating.
Waiting for pigeons.
Not a sign of a pigeon. They're not daft. In the 50s and 60s, before the big time arrival of combine harvesters, harvesting meant cutting oats, binding them in stooks, and then taking them to the threshing machine, which was first powered by steam and then by a tractor. Every year, a group of dedicated Northeast enthusiasts dig out an old restored threshing mill and recreate the nostalgia of harvest from, say, 70 years ago. Ewan met up with them quite recently. So a guy called Charlie Kidd was in baling duties, and Donald Sutherland and his brother Harvey, who actually own the mill they restored, were just making the whole thing go.
Harvest time again, thrashing some of the sheaves from this year's harvest, and we're through the mill, and hopefully the straw goes out one end and the good grain goes out the other end.
So you've got proper oat stooks in the field?
That's correct.
Okay, and this machine, talk me through it, what is it?
Threshing mill, which was built in King's Wells about 1956 approximately. It was a barn mill which was converted for road use. A lot of the barn mills were in North East, all over the farms. They did a lot of their own thrashing when they needed to get grain or straw for their animals.
It's just a fascinating thing of belts and pulleys and driven.
That's a lot of work. Well, when the mill was made, there was every trade you can think of between the joiner, the blacksmith, the tinsmith, the engineer. There's all the trades all involved in building a threshing mill.
And your father was involved in the building of this?
That's right, father and uncle. Aye. Mm-hmm. They served their time with our Garvey in Aberdeen, which is the biggest threshing mill manufacturer in Scotland at one time.
It's just an amazing creature, belching straw out one end and oats out the other.
And when you see that machine at the back, it's sized again, what they call a penny and porter screen. The amount of work in that thing is unbelievable, but there's only one company, it's Penny and Porter in Lincoln. It made them. And if you look closely, the work involved in that is unbelievable.
Now, your brother's just running the fortune down now.
That's right, that's the thrashing finished for a day. That's it, passed for a while again.
Okay, so it's a 1946 Fordson, is it?
Oh, I'm not sure. I think so. I'm the expert in tractors, but I don't know about there somewhere.
Telling you it is.
All right, okay.
And the threshing mill would be from where?
55 or about there somewhere, I think. Some of the last ones. I'm surprised they're still making threshing mills. When you think of down in England, the combines were coming in long before that, but they still made them, still had demand, so that's...
Must have been quite a social occasion, though.
It's a bit before my time, but I have been at some of the threshing at the farmers, my uncle's farm. All the people round about came to help, and they'll row our rocks, and they drove the mill in and drove it. And then, like my mother, she was a farmer's daughter. When the straw came out off the mill, it was taken into the barn, and her job was to trump it all down to get it compacted, and she hated the sight of the threshing mill.
Well, Charlie was around then. I'm going to go speak to Charlie. Charlie's been working the baler. Charlie, that looked like hard work.
Steady work.
Well, you're covered in stew.
Okay, no, that wasn't so nice. But that's just because of the wind. Usually it comes straight down off the shock, as you see, right on the ground, just beside you. And there's no same dust in it.
But you can remember the threshing mill arriving.
Oh, aye.
What was that like?
Oh, well, just had to make ready for it.
It was exciting times, though.
Of course, aye. That was your main income for a year, is this Russian mill.
So how did it work? Was it contractors came in, or was it folk around?
Contractors. Contractor had the plant, the mill, and then the neighbours are come and helped.
So you did one farm, then you went to
He just went for one and then the next, you know.
So you must have been exhausted at the end of the week.
Well, you usually had a week. Some places had 2 days of the same thrashing. Bigger places. And the smaller places maybe had usually a forenoon and then at one and an afternoon at the other.
So what's it like seeing it in action today? It's bringing a smile to your face.
Oh, well, what else can you do?
Well, I mean, do you look back at it fondly, or is that romantic, or is it just hard work?
Oh, no, I never think on it as work. No.
So was there a party at the end of it?
No, not really. You'd work ready for next day. You'd be getting sort of beef.
No drams at the end of the week?
Well, no, usually, sometimes.
Do you get one today?
Oh, no, no chance.
I Donald Sutherland and Charlie Kidd there, and you can see that thrashing mill and the guys in the new season of Landward. And Ewan says it's an absolute delight. I have to thank Karen in Shetland for a card who's basically saying Autumn Equinox, 22nd September 2020, and it's basically Michaelmas. And the trout's reached the top of the burns and the corns need stand no longer. She says, thanks for a great programme, highlight of my week. And it was the time when there would be a Thanksgiving feast with mill gruel for the farmhands. Oatmeal porridge made with milk. Sick luxury, I'm telling you. If you're interested in finding out slightly more about modern farming techniques, this weekend is Virtual Open Farm Sunday, which is taking place today and tomorrow. And you can enjoy seeing beyond the farm gates with virtual tours and more. Just search for hashtag LOFS20 on Facebook and Twitter. We'll save you from our bottle blowing skills, or will we? What do you reckon?
We'll save it, but some folk have got it right already.
Yeah, sadly, I can't read out any of the attempts because I haven't got them. But which bird makes this sound? Any ideas, you can have a go just now. You can get in touch. Email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Stop it. Text 80295. Tweet at BBC Out of Doors and get in touch on Facebook. You can call as well, 08085 92 95 00, and Lewis is back at base to take your calls. We're going to take you on an underwater sound journey now. David De La Haye is a sonic explorer. That's what I want in my passport, who loves to capture sounds from the marine environment. Last year, he spent some time in a vessel operated by the Hebridean Whale and Dolphin Trust, and this is what he heard when they anchored just off the romantic island of Mingalay.
I just remember very vividly a Silurian, the vessel edged around the corner of this bay. Suddenly we heard the howling of seals. We were there late in autumn, late September, so it's a kind of pupping season for the seals there. So there's these harems of grey seals all on the beach. We anchored in the middle of that bay, and this howling was persistent through the entire night. I've got hours and hours of this style of recording. I loved it.
Three weeks ago, I anchored in a really narrow islet on the north side of Muck, the island of Muck, which is a really tricky entrance. And we got there, we dropped it down, dropped the anchor down, and it was about 120 seals within 5-6 metres of us. And as you say, that sound you captured goes on forever. You think, what is that about? What's going on? And yeah, you've captured it in a very different perspective, because you also got it from under the water, of which I am really envious. Talk me through this sound.
Some of these underwater sounds are from Mingalay, but some were, I think, from the Monaco as well. This was one of my favourite experiences, was just being on deck. You could see the seals around you, but, you know, obviously, again, we can't really hear what's going on under the water because we're not adapted for that. So by using the hydrophones just to listen and have them in stereo as well gave a really real good sense of seals swimming around your head as well, I feel. But the range of vocalizations and sounds that I've heard underneath the water, which it was just amazing. It was like being part of this hidden conversation. It felt more like they were actually speaking to me in a weird way. I passed these headphones around to let other people listen, and I don't think any of us was that aware that there was so much activity going on, because I guess because we could hear the howling above the water of the seals on the beach, and so we're in awe just at that, but hadn't realised that this whole other conversation going on underneath. It was amazing.
This next sound was one of those where you weren't entirely certain what it was at the time, and I can't say I blame you. It turned out to be something really rarely captured. Seals clapping. I didn't even know that seals did clap.
No, not did I. Apart from, you know, your film Walrus in a Show or something. There was a full moon. I was lying down listening before going to bed, just, you know, after deploying the hydrophones. I was just listening to all these grunts and squeals and all the things that I was kind of had become used to. But then all of a sudden hearing these kind of gunshot-like sounds. I was really confused, though, because they were really quite loud. And I heard a few more. And then I had to go up on deck. I thought something might have been going on. I went up on deck and took a look around, and the moon was shining and the seals were still howling on the top, but I couldn't hear any claps or anything like this. So I went back down, put the headphones on, and they were still going on underneath the water. And I had no idea at all what these were. About 3 weeks after I got back to Newcastle, there was a published article from Newcastle University, just coincidentally because I happened to work there, from Dr. Ben Burville, who was known as the seal diver. He does a lot of diving activities with seals, especially around the Farne Isles. And he had filmed grey seals clapping underwater. So this is a video that's taken him apparently 17 years to capture. It was always thought to be a vocalisation. To have this activity recorded on camera really confirmed that it was an actual clap. And I was just amazed because I made that connection. I've got loads of these clapping sounds. I presume it's territorial activity, especially as we're there in kind of popping season and stuff. So I can tell you that I was over the moon to be able to capture those sounds.
Sonic explorer David De La Haye there, and just some of his collection of fascinating underwater sounds. You can hear more of that in the Scotland Outdoors podcast, including a rather beautiful sound composition he created from that trip to the Hebrides, and that's available now from the BBC Radio Scotland website. Just look for podcasts or on BBC Sounds.
It's just some fantastic sounds, but a real grown-up radio this morning. This is what radio was actually meant for. You couldn't do this on television. It's fantastic. And the only programme you will ever hear this way is we've got real hydrophone envy.
Yes, I do actually need a hydrophone. I don't know why, but yeah, I need a hydrophone.
A big expensive one. A couple of people getting the bird right already. It's far too easy. Andrew Tate in Kendal, Andrew McLaren in Hoy, and John Wood in King Doldrum in Angus.
Well done, them. Anyway, Matthew in the Lake District says, I'm on my way to do some early morning scrambling in the Lake District before I face the weekly shop. Talk about contrasts. Fiona near Ellen says, morning, folks. Your creative bird impression reminds me of a snipe. Evenings in the Uist, listening to the birds on the wing, the air through their feathers making that sound. No, it doesn't make that sound at all. That's a completely different
sound. It's drumming, isn't it? Drumming of the snipe is called that kind of flashing of the feathers through the air.
Yeah. Anyway, coming up, we hear from a daughter who took on caring duties, Suzanne Powell, for her dad, Jimmy, who had Lewy body dementia. And Brian Burnett, as long last, is learning to gain some calm. But, you know, we just thought we'd give you a wee bit more of this threshing mill. Let's hear it in its full glory. Coming up, it's World Alzheimer's Day on Monday and Dementia Awareness Week right the way across Radio Scotland. So we're going to be looking at how spending time outdoors can help people living with dementia. And we've also got this. That's this week's mystery bird, and we're getting some answers in already, Ewan.
Yeah, I've got a couple I've read out already, but it's obviously far too easy because people were getting it right from about 6:30 onwards. But if you know what that is, do tell us. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Lewis is taking your calls. He's on 0808 592 95 00. Apropos of nothing, Colin and Motherwell said, "Where have all the wasps gone? They've suddenly disappeared."
That's true.
Well, the temperature's dipped. Wasps die off, the queen goes and finds a wee hole. You'll probably find a little paper bike about the size of a golf ball tucked away in a garage or something, and she spends the winter there before coming out to start all over eating my garden furniture.
Well, that'll teach Colin for asking that question, I would say. Back to the mystery bird, the bottle-blowing bird. Ian Infantry reckons, could the sound be a woodcock? It could, but it's not. Hugh Ortney says, any chance it's a coot? Again, it could, but it's not.
No.
Alison says, your programme always gets the weekend after a positive start. Saw the first skein of geese flying safely. I saw my first geese yesterday, Alison. I'm getting ready to drive down to the Clyde Valley to visit friends. Have a nice time. And this is generally saying, soundscape guess, is it an eagle owl? Boo, 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 boo. It's 100 miles off it. It is 100 miles off it, but, you know, I understand the sound of it. Anyway, the walking charity, Pass for All, aim to promote walking for everyone every day and everywhere. And as part of that, they've spent time looking at dementia-friendly walks and dementia-friendly walking environments. Now, one of the folk involved in running these kind of walks is Julie Twaddle, Path for All's Dementia Friendly Volunteer of the Year and also a trustee of Dementia Friendly Prestwick. Julie joins us now. Morning to you, Julie. How are you doing?
Morning. I'm very well. Thank you very much for mentioning my award. I'm normally far too modest to mention it. That's very kind of you.
That's why we're here, Julie. That's why we're here. Let's explain, what does a dementia-friendly walk actually look like? In what way is it different?
It's a good question because it's not that hard to do. So we would love more people to adapt organised walks they're doing to be dementia-friendly. All of our walk leaders have had half a day's training with Pass for All. The walk route is audited to make sure that it's safe and accessible. We include people with dementia when we're planning out our walk to make sure that it's something that would be enjoyable. We have a public toilet, that's important. And before lockdown, a very important part of any dementia-friendly walk is the tea and coffee and biscuits at the end of it. Things have had to change a little bit, but really that's in essence what a dementia-friendly walk is. You have walk leaders who are knowledgeable. You become a safe pair of hands. The walks are inclusive. Nothing that we do is dementia exclusive. It's for everybody in the community to come together to enjoy a safe, fun walk. It just so happens that it's also accessible for people with dementia and their carers.
Well, what kind of barriers are there for folk with dementia and their carers and their families? I mean, what kind of problems do they face?
Well, you know, they say if you know one person with dementia, you just know one person with dementia. Everybody experiences it differently. So there are various things that you want to take into consideration. it is important to say, and I'm sure it'll come up lots of times, that dementia isn't just about memory loss. It can be about mobility issues, sight issues, problems with perception. So say if your walk has got lots of shadows, say, what you'll want to do, a shadow, if somebody has got an issue with their sight or perception, it might look like a gaping hole. So you might find if you're walking with somebody and they stop and become hesitant, maybe it's because there's a shadow in front of them that looks like a hole, and obviously nobody wants to step into a hole. So our leaders are trained to spot these hazards and give the person plenty of time to process what's happening. Say there's a shadow up ahead caused by a bin, we'll just walk around it. And it's taking away that sort of anxiety. That's one of the things that Pastoral has sort of taught us. Also, if there's lots of curbs, you know, you just make sure that people anticipate there's a curb coming. On our walk is along Prestwick Promenade, which is a fantastic location because we've got the beach on one side and it's a wide path that is wheelchair friendly, because I think accessibility is also an important aspect, because we want as many people as possible to enjoy the walks. So it has to be somewhere that's safe for a wheelchair and mobility aids to use as well.
It must be quite rewarding for the carers as well to actually see that positive response in somebody living with dementia.
Do you know, I think almost the carers get as much from the walk as anybody else. It becomes a bit of respite. We've had, and it's also lovely to, because I cared for my mum. I was an unpaid carer for my mum who had vascular dementia. And it can be awful easy to just hide away in your house, because my mum was a very proud person. And you're right, a dementia-friendly community, it's lovely for the whole family to realise that the community is making adaptations to the infrastructure, is putting on activities that are dementia friendly, and that everybody is welcome. So for instance, we've had there's a woman who, again, pre-lockdown would regularly come with her mum, and she, you know, that it was a big part of her week, was a break from the regular routine. And her mum began to recognise our regular walk leaders, and you know, we would talk to the mum and give the daughter a break. And I know from looking after my mum, it's quite nice to talk to somebody else, talk to somebody different, talk to a peer, be able to sort of chill out a wee bit and de-stress, and talk to people who are empathetic and know what everybody's going through. And it's also just really lovely to see people enjoying the outdoors and, you know, interacting with the seagulls and birds, and there's always little kids on the beach. It's a very uplifting time, yes, and it's very rewarding for the walk leaders as well as people who join us.
It sounds ludicrously simple, but with something like vascular dementia, the physical exercise, it can't cure it, but it can certainly help it. It can slow it down to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not a medical professional, but my mum and my dad both had vascular dementia, and what they say is, if it's, we know so little about the brain, but what I got told is, if it's good for the heart, it's good for the brain. So, you know, regular exercise, eating well if that's possible, and yes, some, you know, different things will work for different people. My dad was very outdoorsy, and when my dad became iller, he lost his confidence to go for a walk by himself, and he was always a big golfer, so it was quite a change for the whole family when my dad stopped going out for his regular donors along the seafront. And you know, as a family, you're on a big learning curve when you get a diagnosis like this, and I possibly should have encouraged dad to go out more, but when he lost his confidence, you just want to make somebody feel comfortable, I guess. But yes, going out for a walk, because you see people, you see, having a dementia-friendly community, it's about, you know, the social aspect and maintaining links and connections to your community, and that includes people and landscapes, which is why I think walking is such an important thing to do, if that works for you.
And it's everything else, it's socialising and so on, as you've already said. I think it's an excellent idea. Julie, thank you. Thank you again for talking to us this morning, and congratulations again on your award.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for having us.
Oh, no bother at all. No bother at all. If you're interested in finding out more, or indeed possibly volunteering in one of these dementia-friendly walks, there is a link to the Pass for All website on ours, where you can find out more information about dementia-friendly walking.
Yeah, if we had an award, we'd be telling you about it all the time, but sadly we don't.
No awards. Bad awards.
I tell you the thing. In terms of the dementia thing, nobody teaches you how to interact with your parents that are living with dementia. And that kind of walk is great because you're learning all the time. Yeah. And sometimes it's really hard just sitting with somebody in a chair who's staring into space. But if you get out on a walk and you've got other people around you, you've got the stimulus and you're getting that information about maybe things that you should be doing that might help.
It's extremely difficult. One of the most difficult things professionally I've ever done was trying to interview people who were living with dementia, because instinctively you go backwards. It's pointless. You've got to talk about the here and now to a certain extent, and you have to think of a different way of doing things. So it is possible to learn it, but it is not instinctive.
Yeah, talking about hard work, you've got a bit of a slog, because I've done it before. It's not a slog, it's an absolute delight. You've got a 95-mile walk awaiting you from Sunday, I think, isn't it?
Excuse me, 96 and a half miles. I've checked.
Well, that's if you...
I measured it with a ruler. No, I'm driving down to Glasgow this afternoon. I'm going to leave Milngavie bright and early tomorrow morning. I'm going to walk the West Highland Way because this is its 40th year. Next month, it celebrates its 40th anniversary. Lots of you very kindly got in touch with suggestions of places I can go and have a shifty at along the route. There is still time to suggest more. We've kept the schedule deliberately gappy, just so that I can wander about a bit. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, tweet us at BBC Out of Doors, or get in touch on the Facebook page. Lewis is still there on the phone. You can call him 08085 92 95 00. I mean, as you say, you've done it. I mean, what was a highlight for you?
It just steadily built, Mark. As you leave Milngavie, it's lovely. You get to Loch Lomond, hard work along the east shore. And it just get the further and further you get from civilization, and the higher you get. And you end up on a real peak looking down to Fort William, and at the end of it, I know Fort William's the end, but for me, it was just standing up there, owning all the scenery surrounding you. You've got Loch Linnhe below you, you've got Ben Nevis off to the right. And it is just such a great sense of achievement. It's a wonderful thing to do. And the only thing that bugs me about it is these guys that can run it in 7 hours.
I don't think it's seven hours, but it's not far off it. Yeah.
Well, whatever it is, if you know what the record is for running the West Highland Way, get in touch 0808 592 95 00. It'll make us all feel inadequate.
Doesn't take much nowadays. We've already referred to this. You know, dementia... people automatically think of memory loss, but it also has a physical effect. Back in 2016, when we ran a Memories and Conversation season, Suzanne Powell contacted us to tell about her dad, Bill, and his particular form of dementia, where it was Bill's body that was most seriously affected at the time. Suzanne became her dad's carer. Now, sadly, Bill died a couple of months ago, and when we contacted Suzanne to ask if we could play this interview again, she said, you know, yeah, the interview seems a long time ago, but... sadly, Alzheimer's disease is just as relevant to so many families now as it was then. So, here's Suzanne as a lovely woman and myself back on a walk near her home.
Oscar, come on, you big hero. I don't know anyone that doesn't have some problem in their life, you know. Mine just happens to be my dad's not the man he used to be. But when you get outdoors, nobody knows you. You know, and I think I said in the email to the programme that I've walked this path with tears streaming my face before, you know. Just got it all out the system, and other times I've been in a forest where my son's been mountain biking and I've just sat on a wee tree and had a moment to myself. And, you know, it just helps me realise that this will still be here, this is still here, and this is my space, and everything seems better when you're outdoors. Getting the fresh air, getting your heart pumping, and getting your brain reset, I think.
Tell me about your dad.
Oh, my dad. He's lovely and kind. He was my hero when I grew up, and he's a really funny sense of humour. He was always there for me, always sorted out my problems. He was just my dad. Mm-hmm. Big old cuddly dad. Very gradually, Mum and I noticed that Dad would forget things. You'd talk to him about something and he'd either only pick up half of what you'd said or would forget completely. He then began to get slower, physically slower, would have problems with, you know, everyday little things. Dad's physical mobility deteriorated further, and I went and sought help from a carers charity in the nearby town and became Dad's official carer to help with that. And on the back of that, they suggested I went on a dementia awareness course for 2 hours. And all I remember is sitting down and, she put up this PowerPoint showing the sort of top 12 classic symptoms, and my father had every single one.
Just going bing, bing,
yes,
bing,
all the way down the list. And what it was is the myriad of medical problems I mentioned. Mm-hmm. You join the dots and together they point towards dementia. Mm-hmm. But because we were seeing them all as individual problems, they were being treated as individual problems by all these various specialists, the diagnosis was then revised to be vascular dementia with Lewy body and or Parkinson's, which is also a form of dementia. Now, as a layperson, I thought Parkinson's and dementia were two different things. I thought Alzheimer's was
a different thing.
I think
a lot of people
Yes. And I'd never heard of Lewy body dementia. Never heard of it.
What are Lewy bodies?
Well, Lewy body is, I think it's named after Dr. Lewy, who, from what I've read, my very skimpy knowledge, assessed that this form of dementia, it is a form of dementia, but it affects the physical side of your body. The brain isn't able to get the messages to the limbs, and the limbs aren't able to respond. And a characteristic of both Parkinson's and Lewy body is when they're walking, this is high.
Mm-hmm. There's a kind of shuffling action.
It's a shuffle, just to get the motion forward.
Yeah. Propulsion.
Yeah, and the balance goes as well. But because his memory is still okay, he knows what's going on.
Yes.
And he's very aware.
Which is really difficult for him.
It is. And, you know, toileting's an issue for him. Feeding himself's becoming an issue. Having to be dependent. We're having to bring his bed downstairs. He's so aware of all these things. And the lack of dignity, the lack of, you know, respect for himself. He used to do our garden. He's done all his life. He's been a gardener.
Very outdoor guy, by the way.
Very outdoor guy. My dad, in Northern Ireland, was in charge of 3 different sports grounds. Mm-hmm. We moved to Scotland, and again, he was in charge of sports grounds. At the end of his career, he was in charge of one of the major sporting stadiums in Britain. As a hobby, he would go out and potter and grow vegetables, grow plants and all the rest of it. And this is the first year we've not had any produce getting planted. But he looks out the window now and all he sees is his beautiful garden. I'm not a gardener. He sees it going in his eyes to rack and ruin. He feels he's useless and he can no longer contribute to the family. And this to me is the worst aspect of Lewy body for my dad. He is mentally still able to appreciate what he cannot do. It's horrible to see my dad, this big bear of a man, you know, weeping at times because the joy of his life has gone. He can no longer go out and putter in the garden. He can't even walk around our garden anymore without somebody being with him.
Yeah, I was about to say, you must still take him out occasionally.
Oh, I do. You know, it's one of these things, you know, you and I are walking along at a nice, gentle, conversational pace. This would be really fast for my dad.
Yeah.
You know, and we have to just go with it. Mum and I are adamant we're keeping him at home for as long as we're both able to do it.
Even if you're walking along, as you say, it's almost geological speed.
Uh-huh.
What effect does having, you know, being outdoors have on him?
Well, his balance is very badly affected. Mm-hmm. I can watch my dad and I can see him willing his leg to move, and the message is not getting there. And if he doesn't have something to hold on to, he just falls. He just tips right over. And there's been quite a few occasions when I've had to pick him up off the floor.
Something that I'm becoming aware of just through doing this programme, that it's a sentence in a way, but it doesn't have to be just a sentence. You can live with this condition. You can manage it to a certain extent, yes, as best as you can.
Yes, I think, I don't know, I'm not an expert on it. I can just speak for my dad. But I think when you've got the physical form of dementia like my dad has, I think it's a lot harder. There are some days I wish my dad was as mentally incapacitated as his body is, because it'd be so much easier for him. The one that I've noticed that I have started doing almost subconsciously is touching my dad a lot more. You know, yeah, if I'm having to help him up from a chair or down from a chair, I'll stroke the back of the hand as I'm doing it. And, you know, sometimes he'll hold my fingers while we're doing it. You know, little things like that. When he's had a little accident or whatever, because he's not aware of what's happening, I joke about it. You know, well, Dad, you know, I was in the forest last week and I got caught short. You know, all happens to us, all happens to the best of us. You know?
And it does.
It does, you know. Much to the dog's amusement. Yeah, I didn't know humans did that too.
Oh, yeah. Your dad's obviously very lucky to, you know, what you just described to me is it's a loving family, a caring family. You, mm-hmm, you're obviously trying to do your very, very best for him. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's sad that he can't get the full advantage of the outdoors as once he did. Mm-hmm. How much is the outdoors, I mean, you're out here with your dog today, how much is the outdoors a refuge for you sometimes? Because you need time to yourself too.
I would be, if we didn't live here, I don't know how I'd cope. We got the dog 5 years ago, and I've gone from being someone who didn't do much exercise to I'm attempting my first half marathon this weekend.
Our
local half marathon. And when I'm having a bad day, this is one of my favourite walks because it's just 5 minutes from the house. I come down here and I always say I leave the house with a problem and come back with a solution, or at least a better perspective on that. Mm-hmm. Oh, Dad, what was that story you used to tell me about Joe Bloggs?
Yeah.
You know, and either you'll hit it or you'll miss it, you know, or you'll start off telling you one story and it will go off into something else. And, you know, one thing I have learned is you seize the moment when it happens. You know, my dad, as was, is no longer there, you know, but I get glimpses of him, and that's what I cherish. And part of my way of dealing with this sounds so twee, I have a little happiness book, and every night before I go to bed, I write down something good that's happened today, and especially if it's been a moment with my dad, no matter what it is, you know, whether he's had a period of extreme lucidity. My mum is quite active in various things, and Dad seems to have his most lucid moments when it's just him and I sitting over the kitchen table having a cup of coffee together, and he'll ask me a question, or he'll tell me a story, or we'll just chat the way we used to do. And they're precious memories, which, you know, my dad is gone, but this person that I'm looking after now still shows flashes of that.
Suzanne Powell there talking about her dad, Bill Elwood, back in 2016. Bill passed away, sadly, on the 12th of July. Good Ulsterman, he hung around for that. He was very, very highly regarded by the SRU. He was former head groundsman and stadium manager at Murrayfield. And I'm not sure it's still up there, but certainly his obituary was on the SRU website, if you fancy just finding out more about him.
It's quite a powerful interview, yeah. Mark, isn't it? Just listening to that.
Yeah.
It kind of brought back a lot of memories for me as well. You know, it's not easy. My mum's been assessed as we speak, mm-hmm, and it touches so many folk.
I know what you mean.
Wait, I'm just going to give the phone number. 0885 92 95 00.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it was just what you said, that, you know, sometimes she wished that he wasn't aware of what was actually happening. And certainly with my grandfather, that was the bit that, you know, he obviously found distressing. You know, he would just suddenly have a moment of lucidity and say, I've been talking rubbish, haven't I? You know, and I thought that was the hardest point, you know?
Yeah, and I'm guilty of that as well. It was almost a relief when he kind of slipped into a very different space because he knew he couldn't do stuff. Exactly the same as you said just now. Yeah. He suddenly say, that's nonsense, isn't it? Mm. And he knew dementia was coming. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard for him. And he was terrified of it. Mm. Yeah, but a powerful interview.
Anyway, changing the subject completely. The mystery bird this week. You've got a few incorrect answers. Stop that.
I have. Thank goodness for that, because lots of people are getting it right. Gillian in Stirling says, is it a swan? Not very neat. Clever, clever. Alison in Dumfries says, is it a hoopoe? No, it's not. A hoopoe's kind of a mauvey coloured bird with, it looks like a kind of cockatoo. Very rare visitor here. A bit like, I almost said it. Alan Wilkinson said, it's an eagle owl. No. I'm on holiday in Kings Maybourne. That's in Cumbria. It says, programme's magic. Lorna Dull in Aberfeldy says, is it a capercaillie? No, it's not even close to a capercaillie. Davey in Annie's Land said, is the mystery bird an Argyle steam car? What's an Argyle steam car? That's Davy and Annie's Land. And Brian in Glasgow said, good morning, could be a long-eared owl. Well, no, it couldn't. Love the show, have a lovely day. And really thanks to everybody for getting in touch. What's an Argyle steam car?
I've never been in Argyle. Argyle was obviously a mark of a Scottish car manufacturer, and I think they did have a steam-powered car once upon a time. I've never been in one of those. Right. I was in a French one once. That was quite good. It's a car that you shovel coal into. It's fantastic. We got correct answers from Paddy in Aberdeen, Rab in Edinburgh, Barry Sutherland, obviously, Eileen in Edinburgh, Mary Guilford, Lynn Kenyon, Forrest, and Charlie in Edinburgh. So folk are getting it right. There's no question of it.
Yeah, I'm making it far too early. We'll have to go for a hard one next, I think.
Yeah, it's very distinctive, this one. As some of you might know, BBC Scotland's Get It On presenter, Brian Burnett, is a very keen runner. But during lockdown, well, let's face it, he's knocking on a bit, he's been taking things at a slightly slower pace.
If my lockdown fitness activity was a theme on Get It On, then we might play this. Or this. Or even this. So love me, love my dog. We live the road too long to break up. Ah, love me, love my downward dog. Yep, it's been yoga that's been my saviour over the past few months. It's made me focused. Flexible. And ready to face whatever life throws at me. All right, let's begin.
Here we go!
I run a fair amount. I used to be a good runner. Now I enjoy it, but I've had to learn to accept that maybe my fastest days are long behind me. I used to go out with the intention of making every run quicker, harder, and longer. Now I've realised that a run can be enjoyable as an activity on its own merit without the need to measure your pleasure in miles per hour. I'm lucky enough to live close by to Pollock Country Park, which is something like 146 hectares of woodland and gardens right here in the south side of Glasgow. And running here has been a joy, but with all this running, I've ended up as flexible as a plank of wood, and my knees make a horrible sound every time I get off the couch. And that's why yoga has become part of my fitness routine, and especially over the past 6 months.
So we're going to begin in child's pose, so come down onto your knees, separate your knees, bring your toes together, and just allow your chest to lower down towards the mat and your forehead to touch the mat. Your hips may be on your heels, they may not. Just let them sink back and just focus on your breathing. Nice, slow breaths, inhaling through your nose and then exhaling. And just settling in to prepare yourself for the practice today.
When the studios and gyms closed down during lockdown, I moved my practice outside. And during the summer, it's been really great. When I first started, I got bored, restless, and the ugly competitive side of me began to rear its head. He's fitter than me. How can she touch her toes when I can barely reach my knees? I did wonder, is yoga the sport for me? The very fact you refer to it as a sport tells me it's not, said a wise man. I found myself changing. Outside with just me and my teacher, I've found it easier to clear my head and focus on my practice.
So we're going to take a lunge pose here. This is a really good pose for runners. Bend your knees, look towards your hands, step your right foot through between your hands. Keep your palms flat. Now your hands on the floor either side of that right foot, and you're kicking your left heel back.
I started to approach it not as a means to an end, but as something worthwhile in its own right. Without really thinking about it, I began to feel better in my body and my mind.
If you want to make this a little bit easier today, you could drop that back knee down onto the mat.
I definitely want to make it a bit easier today, that's for sure.
Oh. I'm lucky enough to have two great teachers, one who's been practicing her entire adult life and one who found it in his 40s. And the thing that's different is, with running, you peak. You get to that stage where you're the fastest and fittest you've ever been, and then it's downhill from there. With yoga, you're improving all the time. You never stop learning. And for me, there's a lot of learning to be done.
Okay, let's go.
So I know a plank is one of the things you want to work on, so just some of the things you need to be doing here. Bring your shoulders a little bit further forward so that your shoulders are above your wrists. Now, can you pull your belly in? Kick your heels back, so you want your body to be like a plank, so it's not rounded. Keep breathing, keep the belly pulled in, just enjoy that movement. So the heels are moving back, hands underneath your shoulders, belly pulled in.
Like most folk, my holidays this year have been spent in Scotland, and along with packing some good books and plenty of nice wine, I've been slinging my yoga mat into the boot of the car. I've done Warrior in Wigton, Butterfly in Bankery, Pigeon in Peebles, and my happy baby has been on show all over the country. So today, it's going to be yin, which I've got really into. Yin's like a slower, meditative type of yoga that really gets into your connective tissue. And I've had to learn new concepts for me, things like stillness. I've learned to soften my limbs rather than tense them up, ready for action. And I think the most important thing, well, that I've tried to learn, is that if my mind wanders, I can consciously breathe and bring it back into focus again.
OK, so we're going to take a yin pose next. And the pose we're going to take is sleeping swan, which is a really great way to open up the hips, and it lets gravity do the work. So you're starting in a tabletop position. We're going to take the right side first. So slide your right knee in just between your hands. Lean a little bit towards the right. And do you see how your right knee is going to feel? If it feels uncomfortable, you're going to keep it there. Don't go any further. If you're feeling okay, you can start to bring that foot forward so your shin is parallel towards the top of your mat.
Or as parallel as I'm going to get it here.
Doing yoga in the outdoors this summer has lifted my spirit in these unsettling and uncertain times that we live in. Studies have shown that spending time in nature has a big impact on your happiness. So when winter comes, what will I do?
If yoga has taught me one thing, I think it's live for the present and not worry about what's around the corner. Just learn to enjoy the moment, the right here, right now.
Brian Burnett there on the benefits of yoga, both physically and mentally. And obviously you can hear Brian on weekdays, Monday to Thursday, with Get It On at 6 p.m. And this Friday, for our Dementia Awareness Week, Brian's going to be presenting Memory Radio with the sound of the 60s and the 70s.
It's beginning to think about yoga. It's something I've never really embraced, but I don't know. How about you?
I tried it a couple of times, actually. I remember being really, really stressed donkeys years ago. And a friend of mine took me to a class in Inverurie Community Centre without telling me it was an advanced class. And I was the only bloke there. And I, like Brian, I took it competitively. I thought, well, if they can do it, I must be able to do it. Tell you, by the end of that session, it was about 2 hours long, but my voice had dropped about an octave. You know, whales were responding to me. You know, it was just extraordinary. Anyway, you're listening to Out-of-Doors.
Yeah, I think we're lucky, Mark, that... I was just going to say, you know, yeah, you've got yoga, but we're really privileged that the bulk of our lives is spent outside, outdoors, with the trees. I'm looking at the beach, and the colours are just fantastic, and the birds, and... You know, you disagree with me. Somebody told me once you can never be unhappy if you look up. And if you're looking at trees, you're also always looking up. And it always makes you smile.
I didn't disagree with you. I just sometimes question where you get this information from. That's all. And that's a sensible thing to do, to my mind.
Valid point.
You're listening to Out-of-Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are, of course, several ways of listening again.
Yeah, give us a call and we'll come round and knock on your door with a cassette tape and force you to listen to it. But it might be easier if you go to BBC Sounds.
Or download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to the podcast. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Erin McFadden did. And she says, I've just moved back home to Scotland from Bristol, where I was working for the BBC Natural History Unit. Your old lot, in a dream job. I don't regret my decision one bit, albeit it was a hard decision, and I left a wonderful institution behind. Every Saturday I've been in the UK, or at least in Wi-Fi range, brackets rarely, or if I was overseas for a shoot and could download your podcast, I've listened to your show. There's something really special about listening early on a Saturday morning if you're up and about to enjoy Scotland's incredible outdoors.
She goes on to say, I just want to say a big and heartfelt thanks. Your programme is an education, a joy, an inspiration, and for me it sums up why I moved home for so many reasons. Looking at the summit of Antialaich recently and having just to look and not scramble up as the weather and my solo venture didn't equate to a safe decision. I thought of you guys, championing anyone who just gets out and enjoys what they can when they can. I'll head back up the mountain when I can, and I will conquer it. If anybody wants to head up there with me, I'm all in.
She goes on, I hope every country in the world has a gem of radio show like this, although I doubt it. For those of us who tune in every time we can, thank you. And that's from Erin McFadden, and thank you.
Yeah, and it really does lift the spirits to get an email like that one from Erin.
Karen in Shetland says, West Island Way, stop off at the Drovers Inn at Ardlui for refreshment. Rob Roy McGregor allegedly killed a redcoat in there a while back. Yeah, I'm not sure that's much of a recommendation, Karen, to be honest. Harvey says, just heard of Mark's 96.5 mile walk, asking for suggestions of places to visit. Scott Gold's Mind at Conanish by Tindrum, you visited before. You'll simply have to visit. You won't believe how far it's come along. The Beeb are filming a two-part documentary about it, with the first gold pour due around St Andrew's Day. Fancy that. Well, and Barry Sutherland, who really should know better, says, regarding West Highland Walk, will you be kipping out in your tent or going for a hotel?
What a naive comment.
Well done, Barry. Today's most stupid question. What do you think, honestly?
Susan's been in touch and she said, on the subject of dementia, one of the wonderful staff at the Anderson's Care Home in Elgin gave me this advice while caring with someone with dementia. Don't try and keep them in your world. Go with them into theirs.
Good advice.
I followed their advice and the days that followed were filled with happiness and the making of lasting memories. That's lovely, Susan. Thank you.
Yeah. We've been making the connection today between the part the outdoors and nature can play in helping those living with dementia. Now, when you knew we were going to be doing this programme, we spoke about this, and you've decided to explore the sounds that hold resonance for you.
Yeah, this was a difficult one because, as I said, my dad really struggled with it, but you know, some things took him back. And as I say in this piece, I thought initially it was a bit macabre. I chatted to my children and they were comfortable with it, so I've been looking at some of the sounds that might take me back if I ever get to that stage, which hopefully I don't. And I kind of put it together on my boat. I'm sitting at the bow of Josephine. The sun is out, the sea is sparkling, and I'm sailing steadily up the Sound of Mull. The wind is behind me, and I've 15 miles to go to Tobermory, and it's a gentle, gentle sail. And my mind's been drifting. I'm thinking about my dad, and smiling. My father suffered badly at the hands of dementia in his later years. Every now and again, as he stared into space, a twinkle would come into his eyes. A twinkle that lit up his face. A twinkle that had delighted many a family gathering over the decades. And he was transported back to a place and a time that was special
for him. He'd talk about waves gently breaking on the rocks near Preston Pans as he used a cleek, a sort of primitive crook made out of wire, to catch buckies or crabs and boiling them up on a fire of sea coal washed ashore. Or walks in fields with his pals in a sky full of skylarks. It was sounds, he remembered. Sounds that made him smile. And I've been thinking about sound. It's been a huge part of my life and out of doors. In fact, all of my life. And it got me thinking about what sounds I'd like to remember. Now, initially, I thought it was a bit macabre. But if I ever do get to that place that I never want to be, then I want my children, my grandchildren, or even great-grandchildren yet to come to know what might take me back to a special place and a special time. The sound of a curlew on a summer's night. Listening to the wind blowing through the trees as I fall asleep. Or most of all, the sea. The sea has been a big part of my life, a big part of my career, and central to recreation and leisure. From the paddleboard my father made when I was 7 years old to potter round the coves of Victoria in southern Australia. To a rowing boat, again made by my dad from scratch, which my brothers and I explored the beautiful isolated beaches of what is now Torness Nuclear Power Station in East Lothian. And the handmade mirror dinghy we raced in the Forth. The sea has always been there. As an older teenager in the Naval Reserve, crossing the sea to Denmark in HMS Killiecrankie, a wooden minesweeper which, as we hit a massive storm in the Skagerrak off Norway, shook the entire boat as it crested waves 30 feet high. And then, as a young naval officer in the Royal Navy, on a guided missile destroyer in the seas of the South Atlantic. And later, to the floating oil rigs of Southern Ireland and Yarmouth. To the roaring gales that shook the oil rig platforms of the Brent, the Stapfield and Heather platforms 100 miles off Shetland. The sound of the sea has been the core of almost everything I've done. And finally, to sailing. The tiny 25-foot wooden folk boat with a dodgy petrol engine that took us through the perilous waters of the Pentland Firth, round Cape Wrath, oblivious to the dangers of the Atlantic rollers, and secure in the ignorance of youth. And then to Josephine, 36 feet of 1960s gracefulness, and these are the sounds that are really special. The hauling up of the mainsail, the cutting of the engine, and the sudden ugliness of diesel gives way to wind and sea. The harsh cry of 60-year-old winches. The tightening of the sheets. And Josephine lurches forward like a beast unleashed. And finally, safe at anchor. The groaning and moaning of a boat at rest. And of course, the evening dram and a quiet toast to my dad. This is what I hope to remember. It's the sea. It's the sea that I want to carry me back to a day like today.
That's a really good idea, that. To actually talk to your family beforehand, saying, look, just it may not happen, but if it does happen, and you know, to a certain extent you are losing me, these sounds might bring me back. That's clever, Ewan.
Yeah. Here's my CD.
Yeah, quite. Aye. That's something I'm going to work on myself, actually. I'm really impressed by that. Anyway, time now to reveal our mystery bird. We've got correct answers from Fred in West Lothian, Ruth in Inverurie, Malcolm in Creef, Mandy in West Calder, and John and Lois from Lothian Normancy. Shall we give it out now? Shall we actually see what it is?
Yeah, it's a bittern. They don't actually breed here, but you can hear them in winter. Nothing booms like a bittern. The distinctive heron-like creature stalks through the rushes and the reeds of our wetlands on the eternal hunt for frogs, eels and fish. The master of disguise. The chances of seeing a bittern are slim, but that sound echoing across a spring or a summer landscape can be mistaken for nothing else. The low moan can carry for miles as the male seeks to attract a mate. An eerie sound, mysterious, unnerving, and in many cultures a warning of doom and death. The bird walks slowly and deliberately through the reeds, stopping and remaining perfectly still for hours at a time, until prey appears, and then a lightning-fast stab with the bill ends the hunt. It stalks through the reeds with a retracted neck, haltingly, carefully, placing one foot slowly before the other. They appear as a hunched and shifty, dagger-beaked old man, streaked and speckled with a tawny tweed camouflage.
If it's threatened, the bittern will stand with its head straight up and blend with the surrounding reedy vegetation, becoming virtually impossible to see. If it's breezy or windy, the bittern will move back and forward, swaying with the reeds, again fooling any predator or prey. And if the vegetation has been flattened by the rain, the bittern will lie horizontally, again blending perfectly with the background. It's found across the world. The Native Americans called it the sun gazer, or he who looks at the sun. In days of yore, bitterns have been called by many different things, including the bog blutter and the mire drumble. And it gets its name from that low and mournful note. But it's not an easy sound to make. The male hunches up and sucks air into the body in a series of short, sharp breaths. It's a bit like pumping up a football, and then slowly releases it in that magnificent, deep, rich, bassy call into the night. Bitterns were once common in the UK, but as with many of our larger birds, sadly, they were also good to eat. And they were really popular in the Middle Ages, right through until the 19th century. In 1465, the Chancellor of England, George Neville, was invested as Archbishop of York. And the celebrations included 400 swans, 2,000 geese, 1,000 capons, and 204 bittern. Henry VIII was also partial to a bit of bittern and issued legislation protecting each egg of every bittern in the land to be reserved for the crown. The hunting and the habitat loss eventually took its toll on the bittern, and it grew rarer, and as it grew rarer, egg collecting and trophy hunting became bigger threats. They finally became extinct as a breeding bird in the UK in the late 19th century, after extensive persecution and wetland drainage. They slowly recolonised in the 20th century, but again declined, and another near extinction in 1997, when just 11 booming males remained. But they are recovering. Breeding populations are now established in England, and in winter, bitterns are regularly seen in places like Loch of Strathbeg in Aberdeenshire, and occasional sightings all over Scotland. And finally, to literature and the Hound of the Baskervilles, where the bittern may have been responsible for the sinister screams heard on Dartmoor. A long, low moan, indescribably sad, swept over the moor. It filled the whole air, and yet it was impossible to say whence it came. From a dull murmur, it swelled into a deep roar. And then sank back into a melancholy, throbbing murmur once again. The booming of the bitter.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this week's Mystery Bird Sound, please contact this number.
That was getting a bit dark towards the end, wasn't it?
Hey, hey, it's just such a wonderful sound. Imagine hearing that on a moor at night. It's just really incredible.
There won't be an empty bottle in Scotland tonight. That's not interfered with in some way, shape or form. Everybody going, sitting there going... And then... That's a good one. Anyway, that's almost it for this week. Don't forget to download the Scotland Outdoor podcast, which is available from noon today. I'm not entirely convinced it is a midweek podcast this week, but never mind. Next week. And I'm going to be walking the West Island Way starting tomorrow. Thanks to everybody who got in touch to suggest places I might want to seek out. If you happen to be part of the walk as well, I'll be the one that's pecking. Say hello. From everyone here at BBC Aberdeen, as ever, thanks for listening.